Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we're live for an hour each weekday afternoon taking your calls if you have questions you'd like to raise for conversation about the Bible or about the Christian faith. This is a place where you can bring them up and we'll be glad to talk about them with you. If you have a different viewpoint from that of the host, I always would urge you to call. A lot of people sometimes want to email me with these differences, and that's fine if you want to do it, but I don't guarantee that I'll be able to read long emails or necessarily give a written response. So I'd urge you, if you want to discuss something that we disagree about, go ahead and call us on the air, and we'll talk about it that way. I can always find time for that during this hour. The number to call is 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. And our first caller today, it looks like, is Sandy from San Jose. Hey, Sandy. Good to hear from you.
Hey, good. Thanks for taking my call, Steve. Yeah. I had a question today about translation of the Bible that I'm sort of newer to, which is the ISV. Have you heard of that one? International Standard Version?
I've never used it. I'm not familiar with it.
Well, it's a brand new interpreted and the brand new Bible in the sense that they haven't taken anything from anything old. They've just really redone it. The reason I was bringing it up is there's two verses in there that I've only heard you talk about being interpreted this way, and I think it's in the NASB interpreted this way. But the one verse where it says, do not be drunk with wine, which leads to, what this version says, it says, stop getting drunk with wine, which leads to wild living, but keep on being filled with the Spirit. Yeah. And that seems to resonate with the way you have interpreted that verse. And one other one, too, which is the one that about binding and loosening, whatever you bind on earth. This one says, whatever you prohibit on earth will have been prohibited in heaven, and whatever you permit on earth will have been permitted in heaven.
That's good. Yeah, that's accurate.
Yeah, I don't, I've come across this Bible, and I'm really kind of blown away by it. And so, but if you're not familiar with it, I really can't ask any questions other than check it out, because I'm, kind of blown away that it has these types of translations in it. So anyway, I guess
what's the translation called?
The International Standard Version.
Okay.
International Standard Version.
I've heard of it, but I've never had one in my hands to look through, so maybe I'll take a look.
Yeah, so, gosh, I wish I had something else to ask you today, but that was really the main question, so I guess I stumped the host.
That doesn't take much.
It takes more to stump me, though. So, less. That's it, Steve. Check it out when you have a few minutes, but one translation seems to make sense, okay?
Yeah, those are two good examples of translating verses better than a lot of translations do. So, yeah, I'll take a look.
Maybe one last point since I got a minute. I'm going through your study on Romans, and I just love it. I'm just I'm closer to the chapters where it's going into chapter 12. Anyway, thanks for that, Steve. It's really been great. I've cheated. I'm ahead for BSF next year, so I can be a cantankerous guy there.
Yeah, you're going to be a problem. Yeah.
I know. Anyway, thanks, Steve. We'll talk to you soon, okay?
Okay, Sandy. Thanks. God bless you.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye now. All right. Let's talk next to Bruce from Sacramento, California. Bruce, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, thank you. I've got a kind of broad concept question. It seems that in the Old Testament, when you did what God told you to, things went well for you. And then I'm looking at Philippians.
Unless you were Job, yeah.
Yeah, unless you were Job.
Or David, yeah.
Or Joseph.
But go ahead.
Well, you know what I mean. You won your wars, your crops were productive, et cetera, et cetera.
I understand, yeah.
Then you do, Philippians 1:29 says, it has been granted to you on behalf of Christ not only to believe on him, but to suffer for him.
Yep.
And that theme seems to be repeated through the New Testament. So was that a change? Am I understanding the difference? Why the difference?
Well, there is quite an emphasis in the New Testament on suffering, but that's not absent from the Old Testament. A lot of the Psalms are about suffering. And, of course, I mentioned the book of Job is. And most of the great men of the Old Testament I mentioned Joseph, but also we could add to that Elijah and Moses and other and the prophets. You know, many of them were killed for their witness. So a lot of these guys had a lot of sufferings, and they were sufferings that they suffered while they were being obedient. Now, you're right. The Old Testament law, the covenant God made with Israel, excuse me, did promise national blessing to the nation if they would stay away from worshiping idols. And if the nation was obedient to his covenant, then they as a nation would be elevated above all the nations of the earth and experience blessings in their crops and their cattle and their reproduction and so forth, and their peace. That Deuteronomy 28 points that out. But even so, we are told that Israel would always have some poor among them anyway. So even if they were obedient and blessed as a nation, there would still be some people who suffered. And it would not necessarily be because they were bad. It's just that suffering is a part of life. But the promises God made about blessing and peace and prosperity and so forth were not individual blessings. They were blessings to the nation as a whole, saying that he would exalt them and bless them and prosper them above all the other nations. You'll see that's the wording of the passages. Now, when it came to individual fortunes, that really seemed to just fluctuate depending on what God's particular will was for someone. I mean, Job was a very wealthy man, but then he became totally broke and sick and lost his children. But then later he became wealthy again. When was he most in the will of God? Well, as far as we know, he's in the will of God through the whole time. And likewise, you know, David. David was in the will of God, as far as we can tell, through his early years when he was being persecuted by Saul, but also during the years that he was king, and at least the early years, and so forth. So we find that even obedient people suffer persecution and hardship in the Old Testament. Now, in the New Testament, I will say this. We don't really have the stress in the New Testament on national blessings that they have in the Old Testament because there's no chosen nation. The church itself is the chosen nation now, and the church is not a national entity. It's a spiritual entity, and it's a transnational. It's a global entity. So the promises that Israel would be above all the other nations are not applicable in the New Testament because now we're dealing with an entity that is transnational and spiritual in definition. And therefore, the blessings that we have are not national or physical blessings. They are, as Paul puts it in Ephesians chapter 1, verse 3, they are, God's blessed us with every spiritual blessing in the heavenly places. So we have all the blessings of God as Christians, but they are spiritual blessings. They're not material blessings. And what we do have, as you pointed out in Philippians, and you can find many places in the New Testament that say it, we do have tests and sufferings, and we certainly have persecutions because we live in a world that isn't faithful to God and that hates people. But in that sense, we're not very much different than the prophets in the Old Testament, or Job, or David. But the difference would be that David and the prophets were part of a nation that could avoid national destruction by being obedient to God, although in many cases they weren't avoiding it very well, because they weren't being very obedient. But suffering has always been a part of the righteous person's life. And Paul said, all who will live godly in Christ Jesus will suffer persecution. And there's many, many passages, in fact, some whole books that emphasize the suffering of Christians. First Peter would be a book that is, its main theme seems to be suffering of Christians. Second Corinthians, through especially the first portion of that book, the first maybe 11 chapters or so, or 12, perhaps. I don't know. There's a lot of reference to suffering and a lot of theology of suffering in 2 Corinthians. So you're not going to find suffering absent from either the Old or the New Testament. What you do find different is in the New Testament, what you'll find absent are promises of national blessing to God's people, because in the New Testament, God's people don't belong to any particular nation as they did in the Old Testament.
When you talked about the Old Testament saying the poor would always be with them, wasn't that, I was not putting my hand on it right now, but I thought there was something that said, if you do everything I tell you, you won't have poor.
There are actually statements like that, but there's also statements that seem to be saying that there will always be poor. Now, of course, we're familiar with Jesus saying the poor you have with you always, but he's actually quoting from the law. And the law does say there will always be poor and there will have to be generosity shown to them. But when he says, you know, there won't be poor among you, I think we have to understand the hyperbole. What he's saying is that the nation as a whole will not be an impoverished nation. There will be some individuals who are, but they can be helped by those in the nation who are prosperous. In fact, that's the whole point. He says, even Jesus said, the poor you have with you always, and you can give to them whenever you will. And that's pretty much what the Old Testament is saying, too, that there's always going to be an obligation to show generosity to the poor.
All right, so it seems to me, I'm still not quite getting it. In the New Testament, if you're zealous for proclaiming God's goodness, pretty much universally you're going to be persecuted by the disciples.
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, not everyone equally, because we live in a country here where persecution is much less overt. That is changing, of course. You know, but still in America, we have not had the kind of persecution that Christians have had in many other places. And for that reason, you know, we don't feel ourselves persecuted, but we do experience some kinds of persecution. Ostracism and criticism and mockery and things like that are not unknown, even in this country. Of course, in many other countries, it's different because they're actually beat up and put in prison and killed and things like that.
Let me try my question one more time, then I'll let you go. Is in the New Testament times, especially the people that are given as illustrations in the New Testament, it seems that when they are zealous for good of God, that it's pretty much universal that they have terrible ends. Whereas in the Old Testament, there's a few isolated examples, but there are a good number of individuals seem to have good ends.
In the Old Testament?
Yeah. Even if they're not named, at least as conceptually, the people are their crops are productive and their animals are productive and they're having
winning
their wars and
In the Old Testament, we have mostly national history with certain individuals' lives highlighted. We don't have very many individuals' lives highlighted compared to the number of people that were in the nation. I mean, for example, in the life of David, as you read 1 and 2 Samuel, you'll probably read about maybe 20 or 30 names of individuals and a little something about some of them. But most of the people, we don't have any idea how they were doing. We don't know if they lived happy lives or miserable lives. The main thing is that there's not a blanket guarantee in the Old Testament or in the New that if you live a righteous life, things will always go well for you. But we do have the guarantee that if you live a righteous life and if you're loyal to God, that things will go well for you when you leave here, although the Old Testament doesn't focus on that specifically. We're told that in the New.
All right, appreciate it.
All right, I appreciate your call. Thanks for joining us today. All right, bye now. All right, our next caller is Norma from Portland, Oregon. Norma, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Can you hear me okay?
Uh-huh.
I'm on the speakerphone, but I got it right by my mouth. Okay. You know the verse that says, do not let your right hand know what your left hand is doing?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know exactly where it is, but I think it means it's not doing good so that others...
It's Matthew chapter 6 at the beginning of that chapter. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, that's always kind of bothered me because I always felt like if people didn't know you were doing good or tithing or whatever, I mean, to me it's a testimony, not to brag, but I don't know, a friend of mine told me once that she helped a blind lady one day a week, and she was just rejoicing in the Lord that she could do that, and I was too. I was so happy, and her husband here heard her say that, and he said, now you're not going to get any credit in heaven for doing that. And I thought, I argued a little bit with him. I said, well, I think she will. I mean, I said, we're just rejoicing together. I'm so glad that she has this opportunity.
Right.
You know, what do you think about things like that?
Well, I think people typically, very commonly, people misunderstand the meaning of statements Jesus made in the Sermon on the Mount because they're not accustomed to the frequent use of hyperbole in the Hebrew writings, and Jesus was a Hebrew speaking to Hebrews. And here's what he actually said: take heed that you do not do your charitable deeds before men to be seen by them. Now, that's talking about your motivation. Don't do this to be seen. Otherwise, you have no reward from your Father in heaven. Therefore, when you do a charitable deed, do not sound a trumpet before you, as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and in the streets, that they may have glory from men. Assuredly, I say to you, they have their reward. But when you do a charitable deed, do not let your left hand know what your right hand is doing, that your charitable deed may be in secret, and your Father who sees in secret will himself reward you openly. Now, first of all, we know that Jesus isn't being strictly literal, because the left hand doesn't have a brain in it, and therefore how could the left hand know what the right hand is doing? There's only one brain in your entire body, and no other part of your body knows anything except what your brain knows. So clearly Jesus is using a figure of speech. He's not being absolutely literal here. And if the parts of your body each have their own brains, how would you keep your left hand from knowing what your right hand's doing? Put it in your pocket while your right hand does something so it can't see it. But a hand doesn't have eyes, so it wouldn't see anyway or hear. So obviously Jesus is not talking in literal ways. He's talking figuratively. And what he's saying is you should be secretive about your gifts if you want to receive reward from God. Now, being secretive about your giving doesn't mean that no one can ever find out about it. It means that you're not doing it in order for people to find out about it. Jesus said, don't do your charitable deeds to be seen by men. Now, if you're doing something in order to be seen by men, then you've got a different motive than what Jesus says you're supposed to have. You should not be doing things for that reason. And he says, don't be like the hypocrites who do what they do in order, it says, that they may have glory from men, he says at the end of verse 2. Now, that's what he's teaching. He's teaching that when you do something that's truly selfless or loving or righteous, do it for the right reasons. Do it because you really love and because you know that God is pleased with it, not because you hope that somebody will notice you did it and give you some kind of accolades or congratulations or praise for it. And in other words, not to build your reputation, but to actually help the person you're helping and to please God. And so Jesus, when he says, don't let your right hand know what your left hand is doing, it's very similar to what he says when he talks about prayer. He says, go into your closet and shut the door and don't let anyone hear you praying. It's the same kind of hyperbole. Later on, he talks about cutting off your hand or cutting off your, plucking out your eye. Or actually, he talked about it in chapter 5 a little earlier. There's a lot of things Jesus said that are hyperbole, which if we don't understand them as such, we're going to miss his point entirely. His point, which is not too hard to miss, is that when you do good things, which you should do it for the right motivation. Now, true, he exaggerates a little bit, like, you know, don't let anyone know. Don't even let your one part of your body know what the other part of your body is doing. That's strictly a hyperbole. But what he's saying is be as secretive as you must in order to keep your motives pure. If you are prone to be aware of what people are thinking about you when you do good deeds publicly, then don't do them publicly. Keep your heart right about this. Make sure you're doing it to please God. And that's what he's saying. He's not really saying anything more radical than that. Now, your friend who does the good deeds that she does, she's probably doing it to please God and to help this person she's helping. When she tells you about it, that doesn't mean that she's looking for glory from you or that she's looking, for your praise. She could be, but there's no reason to believe. You don't have to assume that.
Is it right to tell somebody? I guess I'm pretty tight with money, and I always think people think I don't tithe or I don't give. And I think my husband and I give way more than most people. And no, I'm not saying this. I'm saying this because I want to answer. I almost wish I had been anonymous because I don't like telling people, but we give way more than our tithe. And I love giving. But I come from a very large family, and so many of my nieces and nephews have went on mission trips. And I determined from the very beginning I would not give any of them.
Okay, so
I didn't want to do one and not then feel like I couldn't do them all. You
know
what
I mean? Well, this is getting beyond your question.
Is that right? I don't tell them anything about my giving, but sometimes I think maybe, I don't know, I'll pray about it.
There are times when I'll let somebody know what I'm giving. It depends on the reason for letting them know. You know, if somebody says, well, can you recommend a charity? And I say, well, I like to give to this one or to that one. You know, these are the ones I like to give to. Or if somebody says, I can't afford to tithe, and I know that they have as much income as I do, I might tell them, well, I more than tithe, you know, and I still get by. In other words, there might be reasons to mention it, to encourage somebody or to direct somebody who isn't thinking very clearly about giving. You might give yourself as an example, because you might, in fact, be giving more generously than anybody they know, and it may be inspiring to them. But the main thing Jesus is talking about is don't be doing these things so that you can tell people about it and get them to praise you and think that you're a great person. Anyway, that would be my answer to your question. I hope it's thorough enough. We got to move along and take another question. Let's talk to Braden in Victoria, British Columbia. Hello, Braden. Welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thanks, Steve. Yeah. I just had a quick question, or I guess two questions. The first one, I've been talking to a pretty young lady, and we're getting to know each other, and things have been going well, but she mentioned that she likes to listen to Joyce Meyer. And it kind of set off red flag. I don't know if that's something that should be a red flag to me.
Well, I don't listen to Joyce Meyer myself very much. She used to be on right after my morning show. I had a morning show and an afternoon show for years. And so sometimes I would just catch a little of her show after I went off the air and stuff. And I know that she believes in the word of faith doctrine, which I do not. But the times I actually heard her, I didn't hear her teaching that doctrine. I mean, in other words, she may have some views I disagree with, but that doesn't mean they will come out every time she talks. In fact, it doesn't even tell us that they'll come out very often at all. With any teacher that you listen to, myself included, you have to expect that you'll disagree with some things, and you need to listen with discernment. You need to hear what they say and test it by scripture, like the Bereans did. I have to say that Joyce Meyer's way of teaching isn't the kind of thing that I'm attracted to, but many, many people are. She's a very popular teacher, and I'm sure that many times she'll be saying things that I would disagree with. But all I can say is the few times I've listened to her, she really hasn't said much that I would object to. One thing that kind of annoys me is that almost every time she says anything, the people all laugh and applaud. And I'm not really sure why, because she, in most cases, hasn't said anything very profound, and yet the crowd is so whipped up, it's like they're at a rock concert or something. I'm not sure why that is, but maybe I'm just jealous because people don't do that when I say very ordinary things. But in any case, I don't think I'm jealous. I just wonder, you know, what's that all about? But, you know, if you're interested in a young lady and she likes listening to Joyce Meyer, I would just want to inquire, what is it you enjoy about her teaching? You know, how do you feel about these doctrines? I'm assuming perhaps you don't believe in the word of faith doctrine. I don't.
No.
You might ask the girl whether she does. And if she doesn't even know what that is, and you explain to her, you know, clearly what that is, she might say, no, I don't agree with that at all. Well, then it's very possible then it's not doing her any harm to be listening to Joyce Meyer, because she may not be hearing that doctrine there. Or if she hears things, you know, the girl you're talking about could be very discerning. She may be like I would hope you or I would be listening to somebody that they can say, well, I agree with that, and I agree with that, and I don't agree with that point, but I do agree with these others. I mean, we can't isolate ourselves from other people's opinions. We should, in fact, be hearing them and judging all things and holding fast that which is good, Paul said. So that's what I would recommend that you find out is this lady like a cult follower of Joyce Meyer? Or is she just someone who has enjoyed Joyce Meyer's radio programs? If it's the latter, then at least she's listening to Christian radio. And that could be a good sign. Anyway, I don't think that's a extremely, that's not a real great matter of concern in itself. I'd want to find out what it portends.
Excellent. Yeah, you answered both my questions in that, so thank you very
much.
All right.
I appreciate your call. Thanks for joining us. Bye now. All right. We are going to take a break here because of the stations that leave our network at the half-hour point, but we continue for another half hour. The Narrow Path is an hour-long program every afternoon, every weekday afternoon, that is. And for those of you who listen to stations that don't carry the whole program, you can hear it nonetheless, the entire program, if you listen at our website, thenarrowpath.com, where we stream the program live and we archive the programs for later listening. So if you can't listen every day from 2 to 3 in the afternoon Pacific time, you can catch the programs later at our website, or you can get the app for your iPhone or your Android device, and you can listen to the programs the entire hour on those devices any given day you may choose. The Narrow Path is listener supported. That means we don't have any support from products or companies or anything like that. We don't sell anything. We don't have sponsors. But we do pay a lot of money to radio stations to stay on the air. And as long as the money comes in, we can keep doing that and we can stay on the air. If you'd like to help us stay on the air, you can write to The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. That's The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. Or you can go to our website where everything is free, but you can donate there if you wish to at thenarrowpath.com. Those of you remaining with us, please stay tuned for 30 seconds, and we'll be right back.
You are listening to The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. The Narrow Path is listener-supported radio. After the show, we invite you to visit thenarrowpath.com to learn more. There are topical audio teachings, blog articles, verse-by-verse teachings, and the radio archives of all our shows. So when the show is over, come on over to thenarrowpath.com. Learn, study, enjoy. We thank you for your support, and we thank you for listening each day to The Narrow Path. We now return you to The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg.
Welcome back to the Narrow Path radio broadcast for our second and final half hour of the day. For those of you just joining us, we are an hour-long program each afternoon. Some stations only carry the second half of the hour, but you can hear the whole program each day from our website, thenarrowpath.com, if you desire. We are live, and we take phone calls if you have questions about the Bible or the Christian faith, or if you have a different viewpoint from the host and want to bring that up. We'll converse about that with you. The number to call is 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. Our next caller is Buck from Scottsdale, Arizona. Buck, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yes, I want to refer you to the book of John, chapter 21, verse 11. And I'd like to know what special significance, if any, do you attach to the number 153? A lot of people have been dealing with that for over the years. And I'd just like to hear what you've got to say about that.
Yeah. Well, when Jesus appeared to the apostles at the seaside after his resurrection, and they were out fishing all night, and they hadn't caught anything, and Jesus said to them, put your net on the other side of the boat, and they caught a lot of fish, and they dragged those fish ashore, and were told that they counted those fish, and there were 153 fish in the net. Now, there have definitely been people who've tried to attach some mystical significance to the number 153. Some have felt like that's the number of Gentile nations or something that were around at that time, or some other suggestion like that. I personally don't see any evidence that that number is intended to convey any information other than the number of fish in the net. It was a large number of large fish, and therefore I think what it conveys is that they could make a lot of money selling those fish. However, they were being asked again, I think, to leave their nets as they had when they first began to follow Jesus, and to leave those things behind. But it was not a small amount that they were leaving behind. It was a very large catch, and therefore something that might tug them, back to the idea, wow, we could be making a lot more money as fishermen than as disciples of Jesus wandering around. But I don't think the number specifically has symbolic meaning. It may, but there's nothing in the passage that suggests it, and that would make me cautious about trying to assign such a meaning.
Well, you know, in throughout the Bible, throughout the New Testament, there are other incidents where he directed the apostles there to drop their nets, you know.
Yep. When they first left their nets.
That's the first time that they ever took the time to count the number, and he's had
that's true.
Very large catches.
That's true. But in the Gospel of John, in the Gospel of John, a lot of times specific numbers are given, like the number of water pots and how much each one held when Jesus turned water into wine. There's mention of the green grass specifically that the people sat down on when he fed the multitudes and the number of them and so forth. I think these are simply indicators that John, who wrote this, was an eyewitness. He had a very graphic memory of some of the details. Some of the other New Testament books don't seem to have that same eyewitness characteristic as prominently as John. I believe that all the Gospels have eyewitnesses behind them, except Luke. And, of course, Luke had conversed with eyewitnesses, but I think Mark and Matthew also were written by or came from eyewitnesses. John, however, actually has many more indicators in his gospel that, you know, this was written by an eyewitness, and at least once or twice it is said that he was an eyewitness. So I think that's why we have the number of fishes here. He was, after all, one of the few fishermen in the group, and so he'd be one of the people very interested in the fish, whereas maybe the tax collectors and others in the group didn't care much about the fish. So I don't know. I can't give any deep reason for giving the number of fish, but it's just one of those details that John gives, very typical of John in his gospel, to give those kinds of seemingly insignificant details, which simply are the mark of somebody who's an eyewitness, who has a vivid memory of the event. I appreciate your call, though. Let's talk to Reggie from Vallejo, California. Reggie, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. Thank you, Steve. Yeah. My question is, I've been having some discussions with several Christians concerning this new theory on what they call the flat earth theory. I don't know if you've heard of it before.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I've had calls about that.
Okay. My contention is the earth is round. It's a globe. And basically, one scripture I go by is Isaiah 40, verse 22.
Yeah, he sits on the circle of the earth.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So I'll take the answer off the phone. If you could elaborate, you know, speak on that for a minute about the flat earth as compared to the earth being a globe.
Okay.
Really appreciate it, Steve. Thank you, sir.
Okay. Thank you, Reggie. Well, I also believe the earth is a globe. It's a three-dimensional circle, not a two-dimensional circle. It's one of those things that I don't think the Bible is very concerned about. You do have statements like that when in Isaiah 40 that talks about the circle of the earth, though the flat earth people talk about that too, and they would say the circle doesn't mean a sphere, but just a circle. And they would say the flat earth is a circle shape, like a disc. So that's how they would deal with that. Now, I've heard others say that the word circle there in Hebrew can mean a sphere, but I'm not sure that it needs to. The point here is that we know the earth is spherical because, first of all, the Bible never denies it, and secondly, science has demonstrated it. I mean, anyone who gets on an airplane and flies east or west long enough is going to come back to the spot they originated at without turning around and coming back. They'll go all the way around and come back to the same spot as if they're going around a spherical object. And I've traveled around the world, so you know I have some personal experience with that myself. But the whole flat Earth idea has to postulate that the photographs from space, and you know the astronauts who've been up there, and all the people at NASA, you know, who are keeping track of these things, that they're all in a conspiracy to deceive us, that for some reason they want us to believe the earth is spherical when in fact it is not. Now, the evidence for it being spherical is huge. And I would say I can't imagine any motivation that people would have for having a big conspiracy to tell us that it's spherical if, in fact, it's flat. Why would it benefit science? Why would it benefit anybody to have a wrong opinion about the shape of the Earth? Now, of course, the people who believe in this flat Earth thing, they're very conspiratorial in their mindset. And they think that, well, this is a conspiracy to undermine the Bible. Well, frankly, there are much less ridiculous ways for scientific thinking people to try to undermine the Bible than to argue that the Earth is round when it they say it isn't. The Bible does not say it isn't. The Bible doesn't say what shape the Earth is. It's true, there are poetic passages that talk about the Earth in old-fashioned ways in the poetry of Israel, but poetry is not intended to be affirming the literalness of its details. And there hasn't been, a responsible Bible scholar in the past 500 years who would insist that or even suggest that the Bible teaches that the Earth is flat. It may be that some of the people who wrote the Bible might have personally believed the Earth was flat, but the Bible doesn't inform us of that. So, in other words, if the Earth is flat, and somebody's trying to prove the Bible wrong by arguing that it is spherical, as these people seem to think, they certainly picked a non-issue because the Bible doesn't tell us that the Earth is not spherical or that it is spherical. So to deceive the entire scientific community, which I would think would have tremendous ramifications on practical science and practical navigation and things like that, but to deceive everybody about that in order to have the very small currency against the Bible that they think that provides would be absurd. I mean, certainly the arguments about evolution are considerably more in tension with what the Bible teaches and are used very effectively in some cases by non-Christians to try to find problems with the Bible. But the flat Earth, that's a non-starter. That's just not going to go anywhere. And certainly not going to go around the world. But, you know, I have to say that I couldn't care less what shape the Earth is. I know it's round because I don't have any reason to doubt the best evidence that's available out there. But I certainly don't believe there's any conspiracy out there to tell us that it's something that it isn't. I can't imagine any benefit to anyone arguing that way because it certainly doesn't go anywhere to disprove the Bible. So if that's the motivation, it's wrongheaded from the beginning. But anyway, these people, I want to ask them, what difference does it make? How many things can we find to distract us from living the Christian life? It seems to me that following Jesus radically and consistently is a rare commodity among Christians. We don't need more things to distract us from that, like fake controversies. Like the shape of the Earth. If the Earth was flat or if the Earth was round, it would have no bearing whatsoever on the way I live my life for Christ. But I should be concerned about those things that do have some bearing on the way I live my life for Christ. And the more energy and thought I spend on weird controversies, the more thought I'm not spending on the things that I really need to be thinking about. And so I think this is a huge distraction. Like Paul Simon said, there must be 50 ways to leave your lover. I think there's 50 ways to get distracted away from Jesus, and the Christians are finding all of them. And this flat earth is one of the newest ones that I've heard of. Anyway, those are my thoughts on the movement. I obviously don't give it much credit. Let's talk to John from Seattle, Washington. John, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hello, Steve. Hello, hey. Steve. In several places, Jesus talks about my yoke is easy and my burden is light. And then in other places, it says he who will not deny everything cannot be my disciple. I'm not near a Bible, so I'm not explaining this very well. But I'm asking a question about how Jesus talks about how his yoke is easy and his burden is light. Yet in other places, he makes tremendous demands upon disciples. That, does my question make some sense?
Yeah, yeah, it does. I mean, there's certainly more things he says that make it seem hard than there are things that make it seem easy. I mean, Jesus says it's harder for a rich man to enter the kingdom of God than for a camel to go through the eye of a needle. Yeah, he did say, unless you forsake all that you have, you cannot be my disciples. He said, if you don't hate your father and mother and wife and children and your own life also, you cannot be my disciples. He said, if you don't take up your cross daily and follow me, you cannot be my disciple. He said all those things in Luke 14. And yet over in Matthew 11, he does say, come to me, all you who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I'm gentle and lowly in heart, and you'll find rest to your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light. Now, I think that my yoke is easy and my burden is light is related to his statement about giving them rest to their souls. This is not physical rest. When we become Christians, we don't work less or carry lighter burdens in terms of making a living or even just coping with having trials in our life. There's plenty of trials in our life. But he's contrasting, I think, following him with the religious system they were familiar with that the Pharisees presented, which were to, as he put it elsewhere in Matthew 23, he said, woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, for you bind heavy burdens and grievous to be borne on men's backs, and you won't lift a finger yourself to bear them. And of course, what he's talking about is all the rules and laws and obligations and the fear tactics and so forth that the Pharisees put on people to get them to strive and hope to be okay with God. This is a great burden. And it's to people burdened by this kind of burden that the Pharisees put on their back that Jesus said, come to me, you who are burdened and heavily laden. I'll give you rest. I'll remove that burden. The Pharisees won't lift a finger to remove it. I'll remove it for you. And he says, my burden is light. Now, he's talking about the burden on the soul. That's where he says, come to me, you will find rest for your souls. He's not talking about physical circumstances. Physical circumstances can be very difficult for the Christian. There are Christians right now who are in prison in communist countries and have been there for years, and they're tortured on a regular basis. That's not an easy life. But when it comes to the burden on the conscience, which is what I think the core of religious concern is, how do I have a clear conscience before God? How do I have confidence that God accepts me, that, you know, this life is not all there is for me, that, you know, this life may be very difficult, but it's going to end. It's going to end for everybody. And how can I have the assurance and peace in knowing that it's going to go well for me with God? And the Pharisees didn't allow people that peace, gave them all this works burden and righteousness burden that they had to live up to. And a person could never know if they're okay with God. Have I done enough of these good works? Have I transgressed in any way? There was really nothing in that religion that would give them rest in their, or peace in their concern about their relationship with God. Where Jesus comes, says, I do give you peace. I will give you rest to your soul. My burden, in terms of contrast with the Pharisees' burden of the guilt and the responsibility and so forth, is much lighter for you. Now, that is not denying that there are tremendous hardships involved in being a Christian. In fact, being a Christian can bring new hardships into your life that you could avoid if you weren't a Christian, especially those that are related to persecution or those that are related to simply doing the right thing and not prospering in the way that you would if you did a criminal act. That is, you'd be richer if you robbed banks than if you just worked at, you know, as a janitor faithfully for all your life. I mean, there are advantages in terms of the world. There are advantages to not being a Christian. But Jesus assumes that what his disciples are looking for are not those temporary advantages. They're looking for something that relates to God, something that connects them to God, something that puts them on good terms and a good relationship with God, which allows them to have peace and a prospect of eternity. And so Jesus said, for example, don't fear those who can kill your body and do nothing more, but fear him who, after he's killed the body, can cast your soul and your body into Gehenna. That is to say, there's something to be concerned about more than just this life. Most people do anything to avoid getting killed. if they can avoid it. But of course, they're not going to succeed perpetually. They're going to die someday. And he says, don't worry about people who can kill your body. In other words, don't worry so much about your earthly fate and fortunes and condition. Be concerned about whether God's happy or not with you, because he's the one who has the power to affect you adversely or for the better after this life. And so Jesus comes with a simpler means, an easier means of having your conscience unburdened and being related to God. And that is that you simply repent. You certainly surrender. Surrender is a difficult thing to do, but it's a huge relief. You'll find rest to your soul when you stop fighting against God, or when you stop, you know, striving even to please God. You just love God. You just believe in him and are thankful to him and you love him. And then, of course, although there are hardships in life, to be sure, some of them very excruciating, yet if you're on good terms with God, you've got some real advantages even in those hardships, because actually all people suffer hardships, not just Christians. Christians do experience some hardships that non-Christians can avoid by not being Christians, but even non-Christians are going to have their hardships. They're going to have sickness. They're going to lose loved ones. They're going to have problems financially. They're going to die. I mean, everybody suffers, not just Christians. The difference is that God is with the Christian. And when you have a clear conscience between you and God, it transforms the experience of suffering. If you realize I'm suffering because I'm faithful to God and God is pleased, that gives you a totally different inward satisfaction and peace than if you aren't walking with God and you're going through sufferings, which you will, whether you're a Christian or not. So the burden is lighter, even though in some cases the physical burden is heavy. The inward burden is alleviated. And when you endure hardship for Christ, it's like Paul said in 2 Corinthians 4, he said, our outward man is perishing. He's talking about all the persecution he's going through. He says, my outward man is perishing, but he says the inner man is being renewed day by day. He said, our light afflictions, which are but for a moment, are working for us a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory, while we do not look at the things that are seen, but at the things that are not seen. For the things that are seen are temporal, but the things that are not seen are eternal. And that's the difference. Our bodies waste away. Our outer man does perish, but as a Christian, we have something going on that other people don't have. Our inner man is being renewed, and we can look at the eternal glory that is being wrought through the suffering, which an unbeliever doesn't have, can't look at that because they don't have that going on for them. So there's reasons why it is easier to suffer as a Christian than with a clear conscience before God than to suffer as a non-Christian. But the rest that Jesus talks about is the inward rest. He's not talking about a physical, exemption or invulnerability to adversity. Jesus himself said to his disciples, in me you'll have peace. In the world you'll have tribulation. So there's tribulation in the world, but in him we have peace, and that's the rest to our soul that Christ is promising there.
Well, thank you so very much for that explanation. I think I was misunderstanding it. My personal experience has been just that being a Christian, I find great peace and, you know, I find truth, and that satisfies my soul. But I was having trouble understanding the dichotomy here because I experienced tribulation like everyone else.
Yeah.
And so that's very, very helpful. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, John. It's wonderful to talk to you today. God bless you. Our next caller is Dale from Sacramento. Dale, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. This is Daryl.
Oh, Daryl. Okay. My
question, I have a question about the life being in the blood.
Uh-huh.
That when it comes to Christ, the quality of blood he shed, could you explain in detail a little bit about how that blood was qualified? I mean,
well, Jesus, physically speaking, biologically, we don't have any reason to believe that Jesus' blood was exceptional blood. I mean, he his humanity was fully human. And that included the skin cells and the hair cells and the bone cells and the blood cells and every other part of his body that's made of cells. Everything's made of cells. And there's no suggestion anywhere in Scripture that Jesus' blood had physical qualities that are different than those of anyone else. The significance of Christ's blood being shed is that his blood was shed as a ransom for many, he said. He said, no, no one can take my life from me. I'm going to lay it down on my own self. He said, the Son of Man didn't come to be served, but to serve and to give his life a ransom for many. And the Bible indicates that Christ shed his blood, which anyone might shed their blood. I mean, anyone who gets injured badly will shed their blood, and some will die of blood loss. Christ died of blood loss too, physically, but his blood shed, though it was physically not very different than anyone else who died on a cross, was totally different in terms of significance, because it was the life, like, as you say, the life is in the blood, and it was the life of a unique individual who had come to die for the sins of mankind. And therefore it is the kind of sacrifice that it is, and the significance of it. It doesn't inhere in anything that's specially part of his blood, like how his blood was, you know, biochemically different than anyone else's. It has much more to do with the fact that he was different than anybody else, and that he was the Son of God, and he did lay down his human life. He did lay down his life. That's what bloodshed suggests. And that was different in its effect and in its significance than the loss of anyone else's life, because Christ, of course, gave his life a ransom for many. We have only very little time left. Timothy from Ontario, do you have something short, or shall we wait till another day for you?
Real short. In okay. Genesis, thanks, Steve, for taking my call. In Genesis 1:16, it says, God made two great lights. I guess that was the sun and moon. What is the light in Genesis 1:3? Let there be light. Is that a different light than the sun and moon?
Yes, I think it is. Some people don't. Some people think the sun and moon were made there at the very beginning, but that they were not made visible until the fourth day, that somehow there was a haze or something in the sky that prevented the light from being seen on earth, and it was on the fourth day that this haze cleared and the sun and the moon became visible as objects bearing light. I'm not so sure that we certainly don't have to believe that. That's what some people explain. I believe that the light at the very beginning was light directly from God, and that on the fourth day he changed it over and made objects, the sun, moon, and stars, to give light to the earth, so that, you know, the earth would have ongoing light without God being the direct the glory of God being the direct light of it all the time. I could be wrong, but in the New Jerusalem, we read that the city had no sun or moon or stars to shine in, but the glory of God and the Lamb were the light of it. So we do know of at least a parallel situation where there's no sun, moon, or stars, but there's still light, and it was the glory of God lighting it. That's in the New Jerusalem in Revelation chapter 21. In Genesis 1, there's light where there's no sun, moon, and stars. At least they have not been mentioned. And I think probably it's a parallel kind of situation, that God is providing the light supernaturally from himself until the fourth day. Why he would do it that way is something we'll have to explore some other time. It has been discussed here before, but we don't have time to talk about it today. So perhaps in a future broadcast, we'll get into that. You've been listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and as I say each day, we are a listener-supported ministry. We buy time on radio stations so you can listen to us and others can listen to us. And if you'd like to help us stay on the air, if you think the program's providing a service worth keeping going, you can write to The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. You can also donate from the website, thenarrowpath.com. And if you don't want to donate, there's still plenty of good stuff, hundreds of resources, all free to you at thenarrowpath.com.